When investigators finally started following Philip Markoff and his fiancée Megan McAllister, they would note that their relationship seemed one-sided. In doing mundane chores like going to the grocery store, Megan doted on Philip while he was focused on the task at hand. She was always touching him, and she was quick to laugh while he was not. He seemed distant or distracted. Police watched Philip work on Megan's car in their apartment complex parking lot. One officer noted that when Megan just came out to visit him and see how it was going, quote, she looked like she was living in a fairy tale. She was in love and it showed, even in the most simple of interactions. While Philip would have good reason to be distracted or distant when the police were watching them, the small glimpse into their relationship did represent the couple's dynamic, even if Megan didn't know it yet. It was April of 2009 when police took an interest in Philip and Megan, and the two had been together since late 2005 at that point. They'd met volunteering at an emergency room. Megan was a senior in college, Philip a sophomore, and both had their sights set on the medical field. Their lives were busy when they met, and they stayed even busier when they graduated. Megan had lifelong back problems, and surgery that did not go as hoped ended up complicating things. She put off applying to medical or grad school and couldn't work for a long time. Meanwhile, Philip graduated from the State University of New York in Albany in 2007, a year after her, earning his undergrad in just 3 years. He applied to and was accepted to the medical school at Boston University. After a year of being unable to find a job, Megan decided to spend her time focusing on applying to medical school. She had her sights set on a program in the Caribbean. In the spring of 2008, they decided to take the next step. On May 17th, they went on a romantic carriage ride together, and at the end, Philip proposed. The two moved in together in August. Since Megan was unable to work, her parents paid some of her bills, and Philip paid for the apartment. They'd picked up one in Quincy, about 30 minutes from Boston. They fell into a busy but somewhat isolated life. Megan would later recall that she had never really met any of Philip's friends, as he and his classmates were busy studying. But to be fair, she didn't have time to hang out with her friends either. Not to mention, even if she had the time, they were living paycheck to paycheck and didn't have the money to go out. Though a few times a month they would go down to Connecticut to the Foxwoods Resort Casino. Philip would play blackjack and Megan would cheer him on. They'd bet small amounts, and if Phil was losing, he'd quit early. He'd been playing blackjack and poker since he was young, though, so he'd walk away ahead more than most people did. Megan mostly focused on getting ready for medical school, but she did occasionally look for nannying or babysitting jobs on Craigslist. Most of her savings were gone, and she was hoping to find something that wouldn't aggravate her back, but she wasn't having any luck. She had sent out dozens of emails, and the only responses she got back were rejections. What she didn't know at the time, though, was that her fiancé was browsing Craigslist, too. But while she was using the online marketplace for the innocent purpose of finding work, Philip was looking for something much different. This is Monsters. When Philip Markoff browsed Craigslist, he went straight to the erotic section. Looking for sexual experimentation online had been a hobby of his for years, and, of course, Megan had no idea. It wasn't just Craigslist, either. One of the earliest posts authorities would later find that would be linked back to Philip was made on May 31st of 2007, just weeks after he'd proposed to Megan. He'd made an account on alt.com under the username sexaddict53885. He gave a brief description of himself, and then he said he was new to the BDSM community and looking to experiment. He claimed to mostly be into women, but was open to experimentation with both people who were cross-dressing as well as transsexual people. He said that he was also interested in cross-dressing and that he enjoyed wearing a leash and being submissive. He said he wanted to find someone to dominate him. Megan would later say that she didn't think Phil had any secrets from her, and even if he had wanted to keep secrets, he wouldn't have had the time as a medical student. But Philip was very book smart, and he got his homework done quickly. Plus, he didn't actually have to go to school very often, as attendance wasn't graded in many of his classes. Rather, he opted to watch lectures online and spend the time he would have spent commuting on other things. Though the two did spend lots of time together when Megan was home, she wasn't always there. At least once a month, she would go back home to stay with her parents in New Jersey for various doctor's appointments to try to fix her back. She would be gone anywhere from a few days to 2 weeks out of every month. They were planning their wedding to be back home in New Jersey on the beach, so sometimes she'd stick around longer to do some planning and preparation. Their wedding was set for August 14th, 2009. Megan even made a website with a countdown to the date. She included their registry and various pictures from their years together. Perhaps the only clue Megan had that anything was wrong was the unusual number of strange phone calls they would get to their landline. People would call asking about a nail salon, and there was one man who sounded mentally unstable asking for his mother. Plus, they had someone calling to try and book massages. One man, who'd been exchanging erotic emails with Philip, later came forward to say Philip had given him his real name and phone number along with nude photographs, so it's quite possible some of those calls were coded calls for Philip. It's impossible to know exactly how often Philip would meet up in person with any of his online friends. A few people who would end up turning over messages later on said they'd tried in vain to get him to meet, but all they ever got were nude pictures. When Megan was in New Jersey and she called the house phone, Philip was always home. Megan had three older brothers who were all fiercely protective, and they all approved of Phil, and everyone who knew him seemed to think he was wonderful, so she didn't have any reason to think the phone calls were anything other than spam or that he would be hiding so much from her. Soon the secrets Philip was keeping became more sinister. In the winter of 2009, Philip began preparing for something violent. In February, he bought several burner phones. He then bought a gun at the State Line Gun Shop in New Hampshire using another man's driver's license. The man had no discernible connection to Philip, so how he got the license is unknown. He bore little resemblance to the man, but New Hampshire had notoriously lax gun laws at the time, and it made little difference to the seller. Philip never slowed down on his erotic adventures, even as he and Megan planned their future together. Over the years, Philip had posted dozens of ads on various websites and exchanged numerous emails with interested parties. By that point, he'd opened up his tastes to include men and women. How many of those people he actually met up with is unclear, but he was at least sending sexual messages to several people. One of his friends on alt.com described themselves as a homosexual firefighter who was seeking a submissive boy. While it's certainly scandalous to hear he might have been the submissive boy to a dominant firefighter, plenty of people engage in fetish play and it has nothing to do with whether they're violent or not. There are certainly still stigmas surrounding BDSM and homosexuality in general, and they were much more prevalent in the 2000s, but the only morally wrong thing he was doing was cheating on his fiancée. In the book 7 Days of Rage by Paul LaRosa and Maria Kramer, the authors touch upon the theory that it's possible Philip would go on to commit the crimes he did because someone had threatened to expose his double life, and that set him off. It certainly could have played a part, but no such messages were ever disclosed if they existed, though he gave out his real name and phone number to several people, so it's certainly possible. Stephen Elliott, an author and activist who would later speak with the media, said it's important to remember that Philip's fetishes did not have anything to do with the fact that he was violent. There is no statistical correlation between violent crime and BDSM. He also discouraged rampant speculation in any direction, saying, quote, "The quickest way to be wrong about anybody is to say you understand their motives." In mid-March of 2009, Megan went away for a longer visit to New Jersey. She was doing a lot of wedding planning, and she was going to be gone for at least a month. On April 10th, Philip went on Craigslist to browse the erotic services section, which back in the day held a vast array of thinly veiled sex work ads. He found an ad to his liking and sent an email to a woman who'd posted looking to spend some time together. The woman advertised herself as being sweet, attentive, and blonde. though she didn't use her real name online, her name was Trisha Leffler, and she was just 29 years old. She grew up Mormon near Las Vegas, and not long after she left home, she went into the sex trade. However, in Vegas, it was insanely competitive, and as she neared her mid-20s, younger girls were out competing her, so she started to travel. She'd posted up at the Westin Hotel in a part of Boston known as the Back Bay area. It's an affluent part of the city with an abundance of hotels, and it's where tourists often choose to stay. Trisha was no exception. She often picked out cities to work in that she'd also wanted to visit. Philip booked an hour of spending time together, and the two agreed to meet at 11 p.m. Unlike previous encounters, Philip gave a fake name and called from a burner phone. Trisha would tell clients what floor she was on, but not the room number, then meet them at the elevator to feel them out and see if anything seemed off. If they seemed like they might be dangerous or undercover, she'd tell them she changed her mind. When Philip arrived, she thought he seemed normal enough and handsome as well, which didn't always apply to her clients. She brought him back to the room, and the minute the door closed, he pulled out a gun. He told her that if she stayed quiet, he wouldn't hurt her, and he tied her hands behind her back using duct tape. She later said he spoke calmly the whole time and as politely as one can when they're robbing someone. He asked her where her purse was and took all her cash, about $800. He also went through her cards, quizzing her about which ones might have money on them. He was going to take her ID, but left it when she said she needed it to be able to get home. He made a point to look at it for a minute first, though, and Trisha thought he might be memorizing her address. He took her camera and rifled through her purse and suitcase. He went through her phone, deleted their conversations, and erased his number. Then he took out the battery and slid it behind the hotel TV so it would take her longer to call anyone. He picked up a pair of her dirty underwear from a pile of laundry and pocketed them along with a clean pair from her suitcase. There would eventually be a Lifetime movie made about the case called The Craigslist Killer. The movie is surprisingly factual at times, but still takes creative liberties. In the scene where they depict Philip robbing Trisha, they show him cutting the underwear off her body, obviously trying to frighten her. Had that been the case, it would have provided some kind of clue about Philip's motives, but in reality, he neither made a show of the action nor tried to hide it when he stole her underwear off the floor. He left her computer when she told him it was old. He checked her safe and wandered through the room, taking his time. Philip started messing with her a bit, asking her if she'd give him time to get away if he cut the duct tape on her hands, and she said she would, to which he replied that he didn't believe her. At some point, he took off his gloves. He then used zip ties to tie her to the bathroom door and put duct tape over her mouth. Then he took out a knife. He cut the tape on her hands, but left the zip ties so she couldn't get away immediately, but wouldn't be trapped. Finally, he cut the phone lines and left. She waited for a few minutes after he left in case he was waiting outside the door to see if she'd listen to his instructions. Then she twisted out of the zip ties and ran to the room next door. Though it was nearly 1 a.m. at that point, the occupants opened the door and let her use the phone. The police didn't catch Philip, but the surveillance cameras did. The next day, Philip went to go visit his grandparents for Passover, and by all accounts, he didn't seem to be acting unusual. 3 more days would pass, and Philip video called Megan every night. He kept up on his homework, and no one around him had any idea anything was wrong. Meanwhile, the police convinced Trisha that they were not going to prosecute her for solicitation, and she started working with them to help catch the man who had robbed her. The surveillance photos police had gotten of him were fairly clear, and police were feeling optimistic. On April 14th, Philip selected his next victim. Her name was Jalissa Brisman, and curiously enough, she had the date April 14th tattooed on her ankle. It was April 14th, 2007, though, not 2009. The day was important to her because it marked the day she decided to begin her journey into sobriety. She'd been working as a bartender and spent most of her time drinking and partying, but she wanted to make a change, so she quit her job and joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Jalissa wanted to go back to school and figure out her life, but she also had a taste for the finer things in life and didn't want to change her lifestyle too much from the money she'd been earning bartending. She was beautiful, and at only 23 years old, she had youth on her side as well. Men threw themselves at her. She worked odd jobs, modeling and picking up shifts at a tanning salon. One thing led to another, and she eventually found herself in the world of sex work. She'd worked for an underground escort service for a time, but when the madam in charge was arrested, she went to work on her own. Jalissa did not have sex with her clients, but would, for the right price, provide a happy ending. Though there were some clients who really did book just to get a massage from a beautiful girl wearing little to no clothes. She did take the actual massage part very seriously for clients who cared about that. She had her own massage table and had trained under a licensed masseuse. She went back to school to become a substance abuse counselor, feeling called to help those who'd had the same struggles as her. She didn't need to take out any loans and was able to pay her way through. And on top of that, she'd started setting aside a considerable amount of money for her teenage sister, Melissa, so that when she graduated from high school, she wouldn't need any loans either. She took care of herself with her money, too. She traveled often and bought the latest fashions, no matter how expensive. She mostly had regulars, but would seek out new people when she wasn't getting enough business. On a good day, she could pull in over $1,000. In her journal, she'd made a list of friends and acquaintances she'd had arguments with and had vowed to repair relationships where possible. It wasn't just people she felt she'd wronged either, but friends who'd done her dirty that she wanted to try and forgive. She repaired her relationships and made new friends, some even involved in the work she was in. She stayed in touch with her former madam, and the two stayed friendly. She befriended a 60-year-old video producer named Mark Pines who thought she should be an actress. They had a strange relationship, and it's possible he was a client. But her other friends said they were very dear to each other regardless of how they might have met. In April of 2009, just 2 years after she decided to turn her life around, she was only 2 months away from getting her degree. Jack Bennett, a coordinator in the counseling program she was studying for, recalled her as a bit wise beyond her years. She'd come in dressed to the nines, even for early morning classes. He recalled her never being afraid to ask questions or voice her opinion. On April 13th, she decided to go spend a day or two in Boston and see if she could drum up a few new clients. She lived in New York and adored it, but didn't care to sightsee when she was traveling for work. On the night of the 13th, she stayed in the room she'd booked at the Marriott in the Back Bay area and watched a movie. The next day, she went to AA. No matter where in the country she ended up, she'd always go to meetings. She posted an ad to book clients, and a friend helped her field messages throughout the day. She'd given a close friend access to her emails for safety. The ad was titled, Hot Brunette Model and Masseuse Visiting Today. Jalissa spent the day online, where she posted and chatted with friends on Facebook. An old friend invited her to go out on the town, and she declined. She finalized her client's meetings for that night. She'd gotten a call from someone who sounded polite and straightforward, who booked an hour-long massage for 10 p.m. As Philip Markoff made his way to the hotel, Jalissa called her old friend Sarah to chat. Sarah also had access to her emails, but whether she was the friend who was helping her schedule was unclear. Sarah knew her business well, though, and urged her to be careful. Jalissa told her about a boy she'd met on the train coming home from her meeting and how excited she was to meet up with him. She also mentioned that she had a client coming over and hung up shortly before he was scheduled to arrive. Once again, Philip made no attempt to hide his appearance. He didn't even wear a hat. In her line of work, and just because she grew up in a tough neighborhood, Jalissa had discussed hypothetically getting mugged or robbed with her friends before. It was a part of life in New York. Many of her friends were of the consensus that you should cooperate and stay quiet, and Jalissa said no one was going to steal her purse because she'd kick their asses. Shortly after Philip arrived, Jill Stern, who was staying across the hall, heard screaming and loud noises. She ignored it at first, thinking it was a child throwing a tantrum, but when she heard screaming again, she opened her door to see what was wrong. She saw Jalissa lying halfway outside of her room, sprawled out in the hallway. Jalissa was very short, so laying face down, Jill thought she was indeed a child. She asked her, "You okay, buddy?" And when Jalissa didn't respond, she knew something was wrong. She called security. When they responded and lifted Jalissa's head, they saw the puddle of blood that had been hidden under her hair. Philip had shot her 3 times, but first he'd hit her so hard in the head with his gun that he'd fractured her skull. Jalissa probably had made good on her word and tried to kick his ass, but Philip was armed and she was not. She had a zip tie dangling from her arm, so she likely started fighting back when he tried to tie her up. At 6'4", or 193 centimeters, Philip could have easily overpowered Jalissa. Shooting her after bashing her skull in was completely unnecessary if he just wanted to rob her. Jalissa was taken to the hospital, but it was too late. One of the bullets had pierced her heart. She was pronounced dead at 10:36 p.m. Jalissa's mother, Carmen Guzman, got the call in the middle of the night. Jalissa's little sister was sleeping in Carmen's bed that night, and when the phone rang at 3:30 a.m., she woke up first to grab it. She gave her mother the news. When she had composed herself a bit, Carmen called Mark Pines, who at that point was a close family friend, and they cried together. That day, the media was circulating photos of Philip and Jalissa. They hadn't identified Philip yet, but the photos were pretty clear and showed him texting on his phone looking carefree. The media was also quick to point out that Jalissa was a sex worker who'd struggled with alcoholism. Carmen told the press that she had no idea her daughter was making a living giving erotic massages, but was quick to remind them that it didn't matter to her and it in no way justified murder. Investigators contacted Trisha right away, and she was certain the man who'd killed Jalissa was the same man who'd robbed her. If he was moving from robbery to murder so quickly, there was no reason to think he wouldn't kill again. Boston Police Commissioner Edward F. Davis said, quote, "I realized we were dealing with someone who murdered without hesitation. We had the trappings of a serial killer here about to take off." There was the Boston Marathon, as well as a Red Sox game coming up that would have tourists pouring into the city, so police were working around the clock. At one point, the team assigned to the case stayed up for 36 hours straight, following up on tips. One of Jalissa's friends who had access to her email sent them to the police, and they started tracing Philip's IP address. He hadn't used a proxy, but the process would still take days. Philip seemingly had no concern about laying low after he murdered another human being. He went about his life as if nothing had happened. On the 16th, just 2 days later, he went to the Foxwoods Casino. He won $5,300 that day. The casino was near the Rhode Island border, and Philip started browsing the erotic section of Craigslist for his next victim a state over. It's possible he'd seen himself on the news because that time he wore a hat when he went to meet with Cynthia Melton. But bafflingly, he texted her from his personal phone, taking one new precaution but disregarding one he had taken before. Cynthia was a professional who was fully prepared for the dangers her profession entailed. Her husband was staying in the same hotel with her and would always call her when a client arrived to make sure they seemed safe. When Cynthia let Philip into her room, he pulled out a gun right away. But unlike with his robbery of Trisha, he seemed uneasy. His hands were shaking and he told Cynthia, quote, "I don't want to kill you. I'm broke and I just need some cash or some cards." When he spotted a laptop charger plugged into an outlet and asked her where her computer was, she told him she didn't have one, to which he replied, quote, "I will kill you right now if I find there's a computer here." Philip saw her phone lighting up and asked who was calling her, but she pretended she didn't know. When she didn't pick up, her husband charged into the room and Philip threatened to shoot him. He ran to get help, but saw Philip fleeing behind him, so he went back into the room. They called the police right away, but Philip had managed to get back to his car and get away. Days later, police would finally trace his IP address. Though he resembled the man on the surveillance cameras, investigators wanted to watch him and compare his body language. They had to be sure they had the right man because someone else could have been using the computers in his house. He'd also recently purchased a used laptop from another student and sold his old one, which could have complicated things more. That was when police followed him and Megan around and noticed her fawning over him while he largely ignored her. The next day, on April 20th, the police were certain that Philip was their man, but they wanted Trisha to ID him. In the era before smartphones were common, that meant having someone at the station print off pictures and drive out to her hotel. But while that was happening, authorities saw Philip and Megan leaving at around 3 p.m., and before they departed, they put a suitcase into the trunk of their car. The investigators watching the couple were worried Philip was on to them and was going to try to run away. In reality, they were just going to Foxwoods, but going out of state would present its own set of problems either way. Police were overhauling the way they presented photo lineups to victims, so there was a bit of red tape and procedural information to brush up on, and it was another hour before they got to Trisha's hotel. Philip was driving south to the Rhode Island border, and police were worried he'd cross over before they could ID him, which would stall the arrest. But Trisha didn't even look at the entire lineup before she stopped on Philip. The officers helping her radioed to the police following Philip on the road, and they pulled him over with an entire squad of cars ready for anything. Investigators questioned Philip and Megan separately. Philip was unsure about talking to the investigators without a lawyer, but he did agree to answer some questions. Of course, he played dumb about everything, even denying that he ever heard about the case.
If you haven't read the paper, you really don't have a clue as to what we're talking about.
No, I really don't read the paper or watch the news.
So in the last week or two, you haven't heard anything about some stuff that's been going on in and around Boston regarding Craigslist?
No, I really don't watch the news.
Okay, well, just let me give you a brief synopsis of what we're doing then, okay?
Okay.
There's been a series of incidents, robberies of young girls in and around the Boston area.
Okay.
And as a result with that, the Boston Police Department and other agencies have asked the public for some help. They actually printed some surveillance photographs of people that they thought might be involved in this case. And as a result of that, asking the press for some help, it generated an awful lot of phone calls. People are saying, geez, I think the guy who lives next door to me might be a person of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else is calling, you know, I work in such and such a place, and, you know, this dude who comes in here every day, you know what it is, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So we are following up each and every lead that comes across the phones. I can tell you as I sit here, in my limited capacity, there's a photograph in one of the surveillance photographs, or a couple of the surveillance photographs, that's a strong likeness and image to yourself, Philip.
Okay.
One of the reasons why you are here.
Of course, Philip had been captured on multiple surveillance cameras in different hotel lobbies, and when he was asked whether or not he had ever been to those hotels, he said he might have walked through the lobbies, but couldn't explain why.
Just a casual stroll through the lobbies might explain why you were captured on a surveillance?
It could, I guess. I don't really know.
Well, tell me this. Do you have anything to do with Craigslist at all? Do you kind of like advertise or
No.
buy clothes or buy cars or do anything like that on Craigslist?
Well, I've looked at like for apartments and stuff.
Do you? Just recently?
I guess like I probably would glance at them. I've used Craigslist before to search for my old apartment.
You know how you just wander through a hotel lobby for no specific reason? No? Yeah, because people don't do that. He also tried to deny being active on Craigslist, likely not understanding that they had tracked the IP to his address. They didn't really get any information from Philip before he shut down and said he wanted a lawyer. Megan was cooperative, but also wanted answers about what was going on. She promised the police that she would not protect Philip if he was in fact a murderer, but she assured them that he was not. During the end of the interview, she did ask investigators if there was any reason to be worried about going home with Phil. They explained that they couldn't tell her about the ongoing investigation. She tried to ask if he was one of a few suspects or one of many, and they said they couldn't disclose anything, but that it was all very serious business. Though Philip didn't say anything incriminating at the interrogation, his shoes damned him. He was wearing shoes that were still splattered with Jalissa's blood. Jalissa was buried 2 days later, which was just 2 days before her 26th birthday. Her friends and family were given the morbid task of defending her to the media during the funeral, as she'd been reduced to a formerly alcoholic sex worker while Philip was a medical student with a bright future. A fellow student of hers said, quote, "This is a girl who is trying to turn her life around. She had her demons, and she dealt with them. We all had backgrounds, but she was a really nice kid. She was sweet. I wanted people to know she was more than the masseuse." Her family reminisced about her childhood. Growing up, she'd been shy but quick to laugh. She loved listening to boy bands and had a way with animals. She had a dog named Coco who she adored. After the funeral, the media did calm down somewhat. The day after Jalissa was buried, Philip was placed on a special watch when a guard noticed ligature marks on his neck. It appeared as if he had tried to hang himself with his shoelace but failed. After Jalissa's death, her mother Carmen tried to get the police to turn over the keys to her apartment so Carmen could gather her daughter's belongings, but police refused. That would have been understandable if it had been the primary crime scene and if the authorities wanted to keep her apartment pristine to preserve evidence, but Jalissa had a roommate who had free rein over the apartment, so nothing would be kept pristine anyway. The roommate took it upon themselves to go through Jalissa's belongings instead. They found her private diaries and sold them to the press. Though it was a major violation of her privacy, seeing such an intimate look into her life endeared her to the public, and the tide began to turn against Philip in the court of public opinion. Friends and family were quick to defend Philip, especially Megan. In an oft-quoted interview, Megan said Phil was, quote, a beautiful person inside and out who wouldn't hurt a fly. Megan didn't leave her parents' house for days after the arrest because the press had them surrounded. Megan had to shut down her marriage website because the media was mining it for information. She had all of her bridesmaids' names on her website, so the press found their addresses and showed up at their houses too, but not one girl opened their door to talk to them. Sometimes it seems that the press can be just as monstrous as the killer. If there had been any doubt Philip was guilty, it evaporated when police searched his apartment. He had underwear and restraints hidden inside the box spring of his mattress. He hadn't gotten rid of the burner phones he called Trisha and Jalissa from either. Most damning of all, they found the gun and he'd kept it hidden from Megan inside a copy of Grey's Anatomy that he'd hollowed out. Just in case you don't know, that's an actual medical book, not just a TV show. There were four pairs of underwear found. Two of them were Trisha's. When the police told Trisha they'd found her underwear, she told them she didn't want them back. Seems understandable. It was never determined who the other undergarments belonged to. Police made numerous statements in the media asking other victims to come forward and promising immunity if the robberies had happened in a state where sex work was illegal, but no one ever came forward. The evidence investigators had found was disclosed at a preliminary hearing, and with that, the court of public opinion was convinced of Philip's guilt. On April 30th, Megan visited Philip in jail, and her lawyer announced to the public that the wedding was off. Yeah, no shit. While Philip sat in jail, friends and family tried to pick apart if there had been any warning signs that he was capable of murder. He'd had a typical small-town childhood in upstate New York. Most of his friends recalled him being handsome and smart, though until he and Megan got together, he'd been very inexperienced with dating and awkward around women. Friends recalled his prowess at poker and his headstrong nature. He was quick to debate politics, and as an avid Republican in a mostly liberal school, he wasn't afraid to argue. Eventually, a clear pattern emerged. Male friends and acquaintances largely said that they were shocked by Phil's dark side, while women who'd known him in college and even growing up were less shocked. Even if they liked him, they had still picked up on red flags. His childhood friends, who were all men, said they couldn't believe he would be capable of killing anyone, but one girl recalled him bullying her as a child. Tiffany Montgomery, a fellow student and friend, said that Phil would have troubling mood swings that had at one point been so bad she considered telling the school that he might be at risk of ending his own life. Tiffany said, quote, everybody's right when they say he was nice. He was nice, but he was definitely strange, and he was strange in a dark way. Perhaps the most damning account comes from Morgan Houston, a girl who'd been in a co-ed fraternity with Philip. She remembered him mostly fondly. They studied and drank together, but there was one memory that had always troubled her a bit. One night, she and Philip were out with several friends, but took a cab together home because they lived in the same building. When they got to the building, he cornered her in the hallway, pushed her up against the wall, and tried to kiss her. She was struggling to tell him she didn't want to kiss him, but he didn't let her go until another friend saw what was going on and had to pull him off of her. She said she never really brought up the incident to anyone and figured Phil just got out of control when he was drinking. Looking back on what he was capable of, though, she said she should have taken it more seriously. The media was also very interested in how Craigslist was going to respond to the tragedy. At the time of Jalissa's murder, Craigslist was the seventh most visited website in the country. Their erotic services section had been the subject of much debate since the site's launch, as it provided a blatant spot for sex work even in states where it was illegal. The previous year, they'd been told to crack down on things and had done so by requiring those posting in the erotic services section to pay a fee and provide a phone number. That had served to triple the site's revenue, but did little to curb the problems. It wasn't just that sex work was illegal in many states. Police were finding missing children as well as adult victims of human trafficking on the site. Shortly after Jalissa's murder, the website changed the erotic services section to the adult services section, which brought about just a thin veneer of innuendo. People would post pictures in lingerie rather than fully nude. Instead of saying outright hourly rates for full-service massages, they would talk about giving customers a memorable 30 minutes. Eventually, in 2010, the adult services section would be taken down for good. Philip Markov would never end up facing justice for his crimes. He was taken off the watch that would keep him from causing his own death at some point during his first year in prison. On August 14, 2010, on what was supposed to be his one-year anniversary, he took matters into his own hands. He'd gotten a hold of a pen and a piece of metal, which he made into a crude scalpel. Then he applied his medical school knowledge to locate various arteries in his legs, arms, and neck and carefully cut into them. In his own blood, he wrote Megan's name on the wall, then below that wrote the word Pocket, which had been his pet name for her. Then he tied a plastic bag over his head and covered himself with a blanket. The guard who discovered him attempted CPR, but it was too late. He was dead. The Markov case is famous because it's baffling. Whether he had some kind of psychotic break or was a serial killer in the making will never be known. Maybe he was being blackmailed and needed to pay someone off. Maybe he was addicted to the thrill. There are any number of explanations, but they're all just theories. After the necessary legal red tape, the charges were dropped on the same day Jalissa was given a pardon in a city memorial. Boston's Garden of Peace is a small park located behind the Suffolk County Courthouse. It has a memorial with the names of over 700 murder victims. Each name is engraved on a row of rock and arranged to form a path through the park. Visitors can walk on a sidewalk along the rock path and read the names. Every year, the families who want the names of their loved ones added attend a rededication ceremony so they can connect with others who've experienced a similar kind of loss. Though they will never be able to see their day in court, Jalissa's friends and family take some comfort in knowing that the monster who killed her will never be able to hurt anyone else. Carmen Guzman said, quote, "He was a coward. He did not have the courage to face man's justice, but he cannot escape God's justice." If you're the victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to someone for help. Please talk to your local shelter or call the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can go to thehotline.org to chat with someone online. This website is set up so that, at any time, hitting the escape key twice will take you to a Google search page. That way, if your abuser is nearby, you won't get caught seeking help. If you're having feelings of harming yourself or someone else, or even just need someone to talk to, please contact your local mental health facility. Call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline by simply dialing 988 in the United States. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and will talk to you about any mental health issue you may be facing. If you are a member of the LGBTQ+ community and suffering from discrimination, depression, or are in need of any support, please contact the LGBT National Hotline at 1-888-843-4564 or go to lgbthotline.org. Thanks so much for letting me tell you this story. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on whatever platform you're on, hit like, rate us, or leave us a comment. You can check out our other show, Somewhere Sinister, on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, check out our merchandise at thisismonsters.com. The link is in the description. Thanks again, and be safe.